Imagine, you're scuba diving in the crystal clear waters of the Caribbean, right?
It's pretty ideal.
Right. You're just gliding over the sand, you look down, and you just happen to find next year's most highly classified tech hardware
Yeah, just sitting there.
just sitting there, fully functional, half buried in a coral reef. I mean, it literally sounds like the opening scene of a spy thriller.
It really does, but that actually happened this week.
Exactly. It actually happened. Welcome to today's deep dive, everyone. It is Tuesday, June 2, 2026, and today we are looking at an industry that is, frankly, completely losing its grip.
Yeah, losing its grip is probably the best way to put it.
We're unpacking this massive six-part dispatch from Taken Knight today, and the underlying current connecting all these like seemingly random events is incredibly urgent.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the dispatch covers a wildly diverse set of data points today. You've got this highly sophisticated cyber attack, a literal user rebellion against search engines.
The search engine thing is fascinating.
Right. And then aggressive corporate purges, billions of dollars moving through crypto, and of course, that bizarre underwater hardware leak you mentioned.
Yeah.
But you are entirely correct. The through line here is trust and control.
Yeah.
We are looking at a fundamental crisis of, who builds the tools we use, who governs the platforms we rely on, and, well, the chaotic fallout when developers or massive corporations or even just everyday users suddenly lose control of the narrative.
Right. So, for you listening, by the end of this deep dive, you are going to understand the mechanics behind the most critical shifts happening in tech right now, plus, some highly practical takeaways for protecting your own digital footprint.
Definitely.
Let's start with where trust is most invisible and therefore the most dangerous when it breaks, the underlying building blocks of the internet.
Oh, the NPM attack.
Yeah. We are talking about a massive supply chain attack on the NPM registry, specifically revolving around a package called Codexa Joe Android.
Yeah, and this was a brilliantly disguised piece of malware.
Super sneaky.
It really was. On the surface, Codexa Android presented itself as this highly useful, legitimate, remote web interface for OpenAI Codex.
Which, is an incredibly popular AI coding assistant.
Exactly. So developers downloaded it thinking, oh, this is going to streamline my workflow.
Yeah.
But under the hood, it was a really sophisticated Trojan. It was designed to scrape and steal OpenAI Codex authentication tokens directly from the developer's local environment.
And the craziest part, before the Hacker News exposed this on June 1st, it was hitting, what, 29,000 weekly
Yeah,
downloads?
29,000.
Let's get into the mechanics of how this actually happens. Because, I mean, how do 29,000 professional developers just willingly install malware?
Well, the vulnerability lies in the actual architecture of modern software development, right?
Hmm.
Developers don't write applications from scratch anymore. They assemble them using package managers like NPM.
Which hosts like over 2 million pre-written libraries of code.
Right, it's an ecosystem built entirely on assumed trust. A developer types a simple command to pull in a library to handle, say, user interfaces or database connections. And hackers totally know this.
Right.
So instead of trying to, break through a company's heavily guarded firewall, they execute a supply chain attack. They upload a poisoned package to NPM.
Usually giving it a name that's like just one letter off from a highly popular tool.
Exactly. Type of squatting. Or in this case, disguising it as a helpful AI wrapper.
So they aren't kicking the door down. They're essentially just leaving a poisoned apple in the pantry and waiting for the chef to cook with it.
That captures the dynamic perfectly. And the prize isn't credit card data anymore. It's API keys and authentication tokens.
Because that's the real gold mine now.
Right. When developers test code locally, they often temporarily store their access tokens in environment variables or config files. This malicious package was written to silently sweep those exact files, grab the OpenAI tokens, and just beam them right back to the attacker server.
Oh.
And once an attacker has your Codex token, I mean, they can impersonate you to access proprietary company code or spin up massive amounts of AI compute. They can rack up tens of thousands of dollars in cloud bills on your account in a matter of hours.
Wait, okay. So if the NPM registry has over 2 million packages and developers are building at like lightning speed to meet deadlines, is telling them to meticulously vet every single package actually realistic?
It's really tough.
I mean, that sounds like telling people to read the entire Apple Terms of Service before they're allowed to turn on their iPhone.
Yeah, it is a massive friction point. But the sources do outline several automated defenses that don't require halting development entirely.
Okay, like what?
Well, the immediate action, if you even suspect you interacted with this package, is to rotate your API keys, like immediately revoke the old ones and generate new ones.
Right, that makes sense.
Beyond that, the defense relies heavily on automated tooling. Developers absolutely must integrate commands like npm audit into their deployment pipelines to automatically check dependencies against, you know, known vulnerability databases.
Kind of like a spell check, but for security flaws.
Exactly. And they also need to utilize platforms like SMEC or Socket Security. Those scan for anomalous behavior, like a package suddenly trying to access the network or read local files when it really shouldn't have any reason to.
Got it.
But the most crucial takeaway is architectural. You should just never hard code API tokens into your source code, even temporarily.
Because if it's there, someone will find it. And the stakes here are systemic, honestly. The U.S. makes up about 60% of Tekken games readership and the vast bulk of NPM consumers. So this is a vulnerability woven right into the fabric of American software development.
It really is.
But, you know, while developers are grappling with malicious invisible code inserted into their tools, everyday users are actually waging a very visible war against the tools themselves.
Oh, the DuckDuckGo story.
Yeah. Let's look at the sudden explosion of the no AI movement. This is wild.
The data on this is just striking. Traffic to DuckDuckGo's new No AI browser extensions and their dedicated portal, noai.duckduckgo.com, it completely tripled in just 48 hours.
Tripled.
We are witnessing a deliberate, conscious user revolt against the algorithmic default.
Which is a fascinating behavioral shift because people are actively seeking out friction. They are intentionally installing extensions specifically to stop the search engine from helping them, quote unquote. What is driving that exhaustion?
It really comes down to a loss of agency and just a degradation of trust. Traditional search engines basically operated as a directory, right? You query, you get a list of links, and you decide which source is credible.
You do the work.
Exactly. But the current implementation of AI in search uses a process called retrieval augmented generation. It scrapes information from multiple sites and then synthesizes this, like, definitive sounding answer right at the top of the page. But the problem is that these models hallucinate facts. They rarely provide clear citations, and they totally remove the user's ability to critically evaluate the raw source material themselves.
It's basically the difference between going to a restaurant for a textured multi-course meal and having the waiter hand you a tube of highly processed nutritional paste.
Oh, that's perfect.
I mean, technically, it delivers the calories efficiently, but it completely destroys the texture, the context, and the flavor of the real web. And the people making the meals, like the content creators, are furious about this dynamic, too.
Oh, the creators are facing a literal existential threat because the AI models are trained on their articles, their research, their art.
Yeah.
And when an AI search feature synthesizes that work without providing a direct link back to the creator's site, it just breaks the underlying economic model of the internet.
Right, because no clicks means no ad revenue.
Exactly. Which means the creators can't fund future work. The No AI movement is basically a coalition. It's users demanding human-curated information and creators demanding control over their intellectual property.
But is this actually going to slow down the AI wave, though? I mean, you have companies like Google and Microsoft pouring tens of billions of dollars into making AI the absolute default layer of the internet.
Yeah, it's a massive tide.
Right. A browser extension kind of feels like bringing an umbrella to a hurricane.
Well, the consensus in the source material is that, no, this won't kill AI search. The convenience factor is just too high for the general public.
True.
Instead, we're looking at the emergence of a bifurcated internet. You will have the mainstream, highly processed AI web optimized for speed, and then you'll have a parallel premium ecosystem.
Interesting.
Yeah. Tools like DuckDuckGo's No AI mode will basically serve users who are willing to take active steps to retain classic hands-on control.
So users voting with their browsers is sort of a grassroots form of taking back control. But what does it look like when a massive centralized platform decides to enforce control from the top down?
That was a very different dynamic.
Yeah. That takes us to Sony and the PlayStation Store, where they are currently in the middle of a massive purge.
Sony is absolutely flexing its authority as a platform gatekeeper right now. They are actively removing over 1,000 titles from the PlayStation Store.
1,000?
Over 1,000. Specifically targeting a publisher named Webnetic to clear out what the industry calls shovelware.
Shovelware is such a great descriptor.
It really paints a picture.
It does. For you listening, we're talking about ultra-cheap, extremely low-effort games designed specifically to game the platform's algorithms.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about games where you literally just press a single button repeatedly to look at a static image of a piece of toast, and the game rewards you with a platinum digital trophy in like 3 minutes.
It's absurd. But the mechanics of the platform actively incentivize this behavior.
How so?
Well, the PlayStation Store highlights new releases, right?
Right.
So Webnetic recognized that by releasing a nearly identical asset flip game every few days, literally changing nothing but the title and a single graphic, they could permanently occupy valuable real estate on the storefront.
Oh, wow. So they just drown out higher quality titles.
Exactly. And Sony finally realized this flood of spam was actively degrading the user experience and, frankly, eroding trust in the PlayStation brand itself.
Wait, but where's the line here? Because a game about clicking a piece of toast obviously sounds like shovelware.
Definitely.
But what about a genuinely minimalist, highly experimental game made by a passionate solo indie developer? By initiating a mass purge based on, you know, quote-unquote quality, isn't Sony taking on an enormous amount of subjective power over what art is allowed to exist in their ecosystem?
They are, and that is the inherent flaw of a centralized ecosystem. Sony has to act as the ultimate arbiter of value. If their quality control algorithms are too aggressive, they absolutely risk stifling genuine indie innovation. However, by specifically targeting a publisher that was utilizing automated copy-paste deployment tactics, Sony is sending a very clear market signal.
It shows.
They are demonstrating that a platform's long-term survival depends on heavy-handed curation, even if it means acting as an absolute dictator over the storefront.
Yeah, that makes sense. So while Sony relies on top-down corporate authority to clean up its centralized ecosystem, the crypto world is attempting to solve the exact same trust issue using decentralized capital.
Yes, the Bitmine acquisition.
Right. Let's look at Bitmine, the investment firm owned by Fundstrat's Tom Lee. They just executed a $52 million buying spree.
A massive spree. They purchased 26,497 Ethereum.
Wow.
Which brings Bitmine's total holdings to 5.42 million ETH, giving them ownership of 4.49% of the entire global supply.
That is a staggering amount.
It is. And their stated objective is to secure a flat 5%.
Cornering 5% of a global financial network is a massive play. Why Ethereum and why now? Especially with the price sitting around, what, $1,960 at the time of this purchase?
Well, the Takeonite analysis points to four intersecting strategies here. First, they view Ethereum's position in decentralized finance, or DeFi, as basically unassailable.
Okay.
Second, Tom Lee's personal thesis is that the market fundamentally undervalues the network's utility right now.
Right.
But the third and fourth reasons are deeply rooted in the mechanics of the network itself. Ethereum recently transitioned to a proof-of-stake consensus mechanism.
Merge.
Exactly, the merge. And they also implemented an update where a portion of the transaction fees, the base fee, is permanently destroyed or burned.
Which fundamentally alters the tokenomics.
Because that's the point.
Yeah.
During periods of high network activity, more Ethereum is burned and created, so it becomes a deflationary asset.
Oh, I see.
Right? If the total supply is actively shrinking and an institution is aggressively buying up 5% of what remains, it creates immense upward price pressure.
A supply squeeze.
Yes, the supply squeeze is a highly calculated financial maneuver.
But the real leverage here is governance, right? Because in a proof-of-stake system, the amount of crypto you hold dictates your voting power over the network's future.
Exactly.
So this isn't just like buying shares in a tech company. This is like buying up a massive block of voting shares in a neighborhood homeowners association. If you own 5% of the houses, you suddenly have the voting leverage to dictate the rules, the upgrades, and the zoning laws for the entire neighborhood.
That's a great analogy. The governance aspect is the ultimate exercise in decentralized control. However, the analysts flag a critical vulnerability in this strategy.
Which is?
Liquidity. Securing 5% of the supply, which is valued at roughly $10.6 billion, creates a massive liquidity trap.
Oh, right. Because if they ever want to realize those gains and actually sell $10 billion worth of Ethereum on the open market, the sheer volume of their sell orders would instantly crash the price.
Instantly.
They are functionally trapped in their own position.
It is a high-stakes, long-term marriage to the protocol. They really cannot exit without destroying the value of the asset they hold. It requires absolute ironclad conviction in the network's multi-decade trajectory.
Speaking of ironclad conviction and multi-decade trajectories, securing a blockchain requires massive capital, but funding literal moonshots requires so much cash that the equity math starts getting incredibly complicated.
Yes, the SpaceX IPO update.
Let's look at it.
Well, the documentation issued a really stark warning to potential investors regarding share dilution. SpaceX is, you know, financing intergenerational civilization-altering infrastructure, specifically the Starship program and the colonization of Mars.
Right, which isn't cheap.
Not at all. To fund that vision, Elon Musk and the management team have clearly stated they will need to continuously raise astronomical amounts of capital by issuing new shares well into the future.
Now, I need to call out a specific data point from the Tech & Night dispatch here because it just jumped right off the page for me.
Valuation.
Yes. The source material cited SpaceX's valuation at $1.75 billion. For a tech-savvy listener in 2026, that number is absurdly low.
Way too low.
I mean, SpaceX was valued at over 150 billion years ago. Are they referencing, like, a highly specific, heavily segmented subsidiary, or is that just a monumental misprint in the dispatch?
It's almost certainly a misprint in the publication. Or, yeah, they are referencing a very narrowly defined tranche of equity.
Okay, that makes more sense.
Right. But regardless of the numerical error in the source, the underlying warning about dilution remains the critical takeaway for anyone analyzing this IPO.
Okay, let's explain the mechanics of dilution for anyone who hasn't been through an IPO before.
Sure.
If a company has 100 total shares and you own 10 of them, you own 10% of the company and have 10% of the voting power.
Simple enough.
Right. But if the company needs billions in new capital and prints 100 entirely new shares to sell to the public, there are now 200 shares in existence. You still only own 10. So your ownership and your control just shrank to 5%.
Exactly.
So how does an investor protect themselves against that mechanism?
Well, the defense requires meticulous attention to corporate governance. The sources provide clear directives here. First, you must comb the prospectus for the exact clauses detailing future share issuance.
Got it.
Second, you need to investigate the share class structures. You want to look for Class A shares or founder equivalent shares that carry super voting rights. That ensures your voice isn't entirely muted as the share float inflates over time.
Okay. And is there a third way?
Yes. Finally, you look for preemptive rights.
How do preemptive rights function mechanically? Like, what does that actually do?
Preemptive rights give an existing shareholder the contractual first right of refusal to buy newly issued shares before they are offered to the open market.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, it allows you to maintain your exact percentage of ownership, provided you have the immense liquid capital required to keep buying in every single time they raise funds.
Which most people don't.
Exactly. Ultimately, investing in SpaceX means surrendering your control to their capital-intensive vision.
Well, we've covered companies trying to meticulously control their platforms, their cap tables, and their network governance. But sometimes control just literally slips through your fingers and washes up on a beach.
Yeah, the Caribbean leak.
Which brings us to the wildest story of the dispatch.
Yeah, an unreleased, fully functional Google Pixel Watch 5 was found by a friend of Randy Pitchford, the creator of the Borderlands video game franchise, while scuba diving in the ocean near St. Martin.
And it wasn't just a prototype shell either. It was completely powered on, actively displaying the Wear OS interface with Pixel Watch 5 engraved right on the casing.
The forensics of this leak are astounding. I mean, Google has a very long, highly publicized history of losing prototype devices.
They really do.
Yeah, we saw a Pixel 3 XL left in the back of a Ukrainian taxi and a Pixel 4 abandoned in a Vietnamese restaurant. But finding confidential hardware on the ocean floor raises severe questions about their internal security protocols and, like, chain of custody.
Okay, I have to ask the obvious question here. A functional, highly classified smartwatch survives the corrosive salt water and depth pressure of the Caribbean Sea and just happens to be found by a famous video game developer's friend who immediately blasts photos to millions of followers on Twitter.
It's highly suspicious.
Right. Is this monumental carelessness or is this a brilliantly manufactured guerrilla marketing stunt? Because intentionally or not, they just provided an unassailable real-world durability test.
Oh, the PR value is undeniably massive. Google just secured millions of dollars in free global media coverage and viral hype months ahead of their official hardware event.
Yeah.
Furthermore, the fact that the device survived implies it holds a really robust IP68 or higher water and dust resistance certification.
Which is great marketing.
Exactly. Whether it was a deliberate James Bond-style marketing drop to test the market or a genuine lapse in corporate security, it perfectly highlights the chaos of the hardware industry. You can build the most secure campuses in the world, but the physical world is entirely unpredictable.
That is the perfect encapsulation of our deep dive today. Just think about the spectrum of control we've covered from this single dispatch.
It's really broad.
We looked at the invisible architecture of NPM, where malicious actors exploit the baseline trust of developers. We saw internet users actively installing friction to take their web browsers back from AI. We watched Sony act as a ruthless gatekeeper to save its platform, while crypto firms try to literally buy the voting rights to a decentralized economy.
And we examine the mathematical certainty of equity dilution in the pursuit of space exploration, juxtaposed against a multi-billion-dollar tech giant just losing its unreleased hardware to the ocean currents.
It all comes back to the infrastructure we rely on and what happens when the people building it or the people using it push back.
Which leaves us with a critical concept to consider moving forward.
Okay.
Throughout this dispatch, we've looked at the constant tug of war for control users fighting algorithms, companies fighting developers. But as these systems evolve, particularly with the rise of autonomous AI agents and self-executing blockchain protocols, we are approaching a threshold where human oversight is actively being engineered out of the loop.
Wow, yeah.
So what happens to our concept of trust when the next generation of digital infrastructure is designed specifically not to need our permission, our intervention, or our control at all?
That is a fundamental shift in how we will interact with technology, and definitely a thought that is going to linger for you as you mull all this over. Thank you for joining the conversation today. You are now armed with the most vital mechanics behind today's tech frontier. So keep a close eye on your API keys, definitely check your browser extensions, and we will see you on the next deep dive.